Hello and welcome to the Bedrosian Center's Book Club podcast, where we read and discuss a book every month, sometimes two. We read new and classic works, fiction and non, through a lens of governance to get at what it really means to be in community today. I'm Lisa Schweitzer. I'm a professor in the Department of Urban Planning and Spatial Analysis and Gender and Sexuality Studies here at the University of Southern California. Today we have a special episode where we always try to bring in our USC authors and friends of the podcast. And today I'm extremely excited to talk to a friend of mine, a friend and a former student. I'm totally taking credit for how brilliant he is. It was all me. In his book, and one of the reasons why it's so cool is that it's such a timely and policy relevant book, which makes it even more wonderful for this podcast. The book that we're talking about today is The Affordable City, and we have Shane Phillip, the author, with us today. Hi, Shane.
Hey, Lisa.
Could you introduce what you do, what you're doing right now, and in addition to, I think, adjuncting for us, right?
Until recently, yes. My full-time job, though, since last year is at the UCLA Lewis Center, so I'm kind of crossing between the two, UCLA and USC. But there, we just started a housing initiative within the Lewis Center, and so that's basically me at this point and on the staff side, plus we have faculty, of course, who've been working on housing for a long time. And so, you know, it's trying to sort of build that up from the ground and, you know, do a lot of different work and, you know, lots of things related to kind of big picture supply and those kinds of things, but also lots of tenant protection and funding type things. I'm sure you've seen some of the things we published in the last year.
Certainly.
You know, beyond the big picture research, also trying to do more. Someone described it as like policy entrepreneurship, which I liked that term, which is really just like quick hit, kind of like here's a policy reform that we could do and maybe we should do and here's why, and then trying to get that to the right people. And yeah, until recently, I taught for 2 quarters as an adjunct at USC, but that plus this was just too much. So I said, 2 quarters is good for now. Maybe I'll come back sometime later.
All right. Well, don't be a stranger because we like having you back here at home as much as it galls me to have to share you with UCLA. yeah, I remember you and I maybe 3 years ago. I've lost all track of time, but maybe 3-4 years ago, going to lunch over at the B School, and you saying to me, you know, I'd really like to get more into housing policy. I'm going to say that you did that.
I guess, yeah. Yeah, that was probably about 3 years ago.
Yeah.
That was right around when I had started or was shortly going to be starting at Central City Association, where I got to work on housing policy a lot more. You know, I've been writing about it in my free time, but didn't have a way to kind of do the work day to day.
And so what prompted your desire to jump in there?
The answer I always give is, you know, I had focused on transportation policy primarily, and that's sort of what got me into planning, you know, starting maybe almost 10 years ago. And, you know, I think transportation, it's obviously extremely important and very closely tied to housing. But, you know, here where I'm from in Seattle, in many places, it feels like, maybe not so much recently, but in general, it feels like we're moving the right direction on transportation, albeit, you know, too slowly. But on housing, it felt like actually in many ways we were moving backwards. And so I think it was partly that, just wanting to work where it felt it was most needed. And also, you know, it just seemed so central to everything, including transportation. And it, you know, it sort of seems like if we can't get the housing right, it's very hard to get the transportation right.
Well, the book's titled The Affordable City, and it's subtitled Strategies for Putting Housing Within Reach and Keeping It There. The book is from Island Press, which for our listeners who are not familiar with Island Press, it's a marvelous publisher who focuses a lot on urban issues and environmental issues, particularly ones that have a focus on inclusive environmentalism, inclusive cities, trying to find policies that really do work across a broad spectrum of race and class. And so I highly recommend their catalog in general. And it's just, this book made all sorts of sense to me when you told me that you were going to write it. How do we make housing affordable and keep it there? Shane. You've got a two-sentence summary on your Twitter feed. You want to give us that?
I would have to find it. You know, the motivation for the book was sort of a frustration that, you know, housing debates in many places, including Los Angeles, are really kind of defined by their polls, and are treated as like these positions are mutually exclusive, where, you know, if you're pro-housing, then you're anti-tenant. Mm-hmm. And if you're pro-tenant, then you're anti-housing. Mm-hmm. And I just think that's wrong ultimately, and doesn't actually represent the views of a lot of, you know, professional planners and advocates and others. And so I wanted to lay out an argument for why that's not actually the case. And you can and we should be both pro-housing and pro-tenant. And, right. You know, I kind of break that down into what I call in the book the three S's of supply, stability, and subsidy. So, you know, mm-hmm. supply kind of corresponds to the pro-housing, stability kind of corresponds to pro-tenant, and the subsidy is sort of like how you fund and incentivize those other activities.
Right.
So that was the big picture motivation, and not just wanting to, so I kind of wanted to plant the flag and say, like, you can be this, you don't have to pick. And, you know, beyond making that argument kind of philosophically, I also wanted to actually make it useful to people who are not spending all of their time thinking about this, where they could actually use it as a reference and look up specific policies for how to achieve those goals and make them work together.
Well, that's a pretty excellent summary. I don't think we need to bother looking up your tweet.
That was more than 280 characters.
That's all right. I believe you've got, what is it, about 50?
Yeah.
53?
It's kind of broken up.
You've got about 53 policy guides.
Yeah. There's the three S's, supply, stability, and subsidy. Each of those has, you know, 12 or 15 policies underneath them. There's also just some kind of like higher level general principles, recommendations for all of this that start even before those policies. But yeah, that's kind of the structure. I would say, you know, maybe 2/3 of the book is these recommendations and policies, which, you know, I've read plenty of housing books and I feel like they all have a different angle and many of them are very good, but they are usually very focused on the problem. And so, you know, I wanted to do something that was more focused on the solutions and not to be the final word on exactly what we need to do, but at least to, you know, put those ideas out there and at least help people think about what they, like, put in those considerations if they do want to move forward with these policies. Like, what should I be thinking about if I haven't thought about this in the past?
All right, I'm going to be mean, which you should be used to.
Mm-hmm.
I was Shane's planning theory instructor, which getting up in the morning to be mean is kind of a requirement for theory instructors. Let's say that I was able to hold you captive, and you have to pick 5 of these,
mm-hmm.
or else you will have to sit and listen to Kenny G for extended periods of time. My apologies to all Kenny G fans.
You're presuming that I wouldn't enjoy that.
Yes, but I just feel like there's enough violence in the world without issuing a real threat. I just want you to maybe pick, I have my 5,
mm-hmm.
and I'm just kind of wondering what yours are.
Yeah, that's tough, but... I mean, certainly I think 2 of the big ones that map onto the sort of pro-housing and pro-tenant, are really just upzoning and rent control. And, you know, the specifics of those are very important. And I go into a lot of detail. Each of those categories actually breaks down into like several recommendations actually.
Yeah, absolutely. There are big recommendations and small ones in here.
That's 2 things for sure. Beyond that, I think, you know, having the right funding for the people that, you know, new supply won't necessarily help and also tenant protections won't necessarily help is important. And so my preferred source of funding is property taxes. Not much of an option here in California, unfortunately, but I think just because of how they incentivize the things we want to see in terms of, you know, using property more productively and not hoarding it, as we see in lots of places with really low property taxes, including California, but especially places like Vancouver, which I think has a property tax of like 0.2 or 3% or something shockingly low. And it's a wealth tax effectively, which I like. So that's three.
So, can I stop you before we get to four?
Yeah.
You know, a lot of our listeners are going to be probably Shane Phillips fan people, assuming that you have more than just fanboys. So they're going to know what upzoning is, but it's a general governance podcast. And so upzoning is it's a wonky term. Let's define it.
Yeah.
And let's talk about why it would be so meaningful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So upzoning essentially just means changing what is legal to build on a parcel of land, and specifically to allow more. That's why it's upzoning as opposed to downzoning, which would be to allow less. And so this is the main argument of the supply aspect of this book, is that essentially, if you have a growing population, as we do, and high demand, really the most important thing you can do is have enough to go around for everyone. And if you don't have enough to go around, if you have scarcity, the people with the most money are going to, for one, just win, and they're going to bid up the prices for everyone else, which is certainly what we see here in LA. And, I think a lot of people kind of stop at that argument and just say, if we just build enough housing, everything will be rosy. And I think it's very clear that that's not the case, especially when we've gotten to the state that somewhere like Los Angeles is in, where, it costs $500,000 to build a new unit. You can build those all day long. And, if the median income is $50,000, a lot of people are not going to be directly helped by that. Even if their rent goes down slightly, it still doesn't do the whole job. So
at one point in the book, you say very explicitly, pick affordability or rising home values.
That's right. Yeah.
And this really gets at the heart of that.
Yeah.
Right. You can either have people be using homes as their primary means of building wealth, mm-hmm. asset wealth, or you can make cities affordable. It's not going to happen.
Yeah, ultimately, if your home is going up in value faster than inflation or wages or what have you, then, that value is coming at the expense of someone else. And so, and it's coming at the expense of future buyers, future generations. And so, that is the fundamental concern. And I think a lot of politicians and really just people generally kind of talk a good game about affordability, but they also talk about preserving and boosting home values. And when you get down to it, you really can't do both at the same time. There is a trade-off inherent in that.
Yeah. Okay. So your first three were upzoning, mm-hmm. rent control. And then the third, I think, sounded a little bit like making approvals faster and easier and cheaper.
No. Property taxes.
Property taxes. All right.
Higher property taxes. And that's not even like, if you're
I don't
not,
think you should run for office on this platform, kiddo. Okay. And so what's number four?
So number four, this is where it gets a little more, choosing now is difficult. I think.
Oh, well, can we add my two then that I would add to those then? Let's add making approvals faster and cheaper, mm-hmm. simpler.
That's one.
I think that's a biggie.
Yeah.
And then the other one is parking requirements.
Yeah.
But for me, I think that's actually kind of a bigger ticket item.
Yeah, it's huge, of course.
It just adds a lot of cost. In cities where land values are high, having non-market set parking requirements adds a lot of upfront costs to any development proposal that's just going to chase a lot of people out of even considering doing it. And for what we get out of that regulation, it's not worth it.
Yeah. It can cost, depending on how you build parking, especially if it's underground, you can get up to $50,000 per space or more.
All to store something.
Yeah. And $50,000, it sounds a lot in its own right, but if you want to convert that into a monthly rent that the developer has to recoup just to pay off the cost, not even to earn a profit on it. We're talking $200-$300 a month just for one parking space. And as someone who hasn't owned a car in like 13 years, it was really frustrating trying to look for places, especially if you were looking at a newer apartments where there's basically nothing that doesn't have parking and quite a bit of it. And knowing that, they're charging $100 a month for a parking space, but it's costing them $300 a month. And so even if I don't buy a parking space, I'm still paying a couple hundred dollars just in my rent because it's just getting bundled into that. So that's definitely a big one. One thing that I did want to add, a policy that I think, because, you know, if you're a planner, you know, parking is an issue, and that's a common thing that's discussed. One that I think is a little more of a novel idea is having a really robust rental registry. And this is something that Los Angeles has for its rent stabilized housing stock, which is the majority of its rental housing stock, but it's not very effective right now. It's very new. It's only a few years old. But the idea behind the rent registry is it's really a way to hold landlords accountable to the requirements we are imposing on them, because we know we have rent control, we have eviction protections, we have all of these things. But very often, you know, a landlord will serve an eviction notice or just like a, you know, what's the word? Like a, not an official, but an unofficial eviction notice just says like, you have to leave. And the tenant doesn't know any better, because why would you? And you take that as like, well, I guess I got to go. And so it may not have been actually legal to evict them, and yet they leave because they don't know better. And so the idea behind this really is just you require the landlord to just tell the city when they're serving an eviction, when they're raising the rent, and by how much. Basic things like that. Not even to get the city's approval, but just to have a record of it. And then the tenant, when they receive that notice, or when they receive a notice at all, they can then go check and see, did the landlord tell the city that they're doing this? And did they say that they're doing what they're telling me they're doing? Do they match?
Right.
And that can basically serve as, for one, it's a deterrent in the first place. So some of these things won't occur at all because, you know, the landlord doesn't want to tell on themselves, basically. But it's also sort of a self-enforcing program to some extent. And there's a lot of things you can do.
Well, it's a transparency and accountability structure, right? Because even if, just getting outside of your example, being able to, as a renter, look at what other landlords are doing.
Right.
Looking at what other landlords besides yours are doing in a systematic way, besides just catch as catch can and word of mouth. Like, okay, my rent just went up by $100 this year and everybody else just, what I'm seeing here is $25. Why are you doing this? Like, what's the justification for this?
I mean, housing data and information is just so poor. You know, we don't know in any city what the rents people are paying. We kind of have an idea a couple years later through the American Community Survey. But we also don't know what evictions are happening at the city level because those go through the courts. And so again, it's a pretty simple way just to make, again, sort of make landlords tell on themselves in a really low cost. You know, you're not even saying like, we have to sign off on your eviction or rent.
This isn't an approvals process. This is a reporting.
Yeah.
Right? This is, yeah.
Yeah.
This is the database that we're building.
I come down kind of hard on landlords in a lot of the book and to distinguish them from developers who deserve criticism in many, many cases as well. But just that distinction is important, I think. And so it's something I really come back to a lot in the book.
You know, I think we're going to go forward with the assumption that these are big kids and can take care of themselves.
Yeah.
You know? Nobody worries about my feelings. It seems like.
Well, I mean, you might know, I was lucky enough to buy a duplex a few years ago, and there's a below market tenant in the other unit, and the household that I replaced, they owned the building. So it was just kind of a one for one replacement. But it's just crazy to me that I'm a landlord now and I didn't have to do any training. There's nothing. Like, all you have to have is a decent income. Mm-hmm. A small amount of savings and a good credit score. And like, I have a meaningful responsibility over these people's lives.
Right. You have, well, you may, no. You know, you plus your heart are framing it as a responsibility.
Yeah.
As other people might call it power and control.
Yeah.
Right. And whenever there is power and control, it's always a role that requires scrutiny.
Yeah.
Which is one of the reasons why I laugh about how people aren't terribly worried about my feelings. But, you know, hey, you know, universities and professors, you know, are legitimately objects of scrutiny and should be accountable in the same way that other positions of power should be.
Mm-hmm.
Can we go back to either affordability or wealth and asset accumulation?
Yeah, there's a lot there.
Well, there is a lot there. And it's just, for me, one of the real stumbling points in the world, right? And you never want to let, as they say, the perfect be the enemy of the good. But, you know, the tendency for the U.S. to rely on private systems and private institutions for social welfare policy,
mm-hmm.
it's by far, in terms of, I really cannot think of another country in terms of social policy that, maybe I'm wrong about this, but I really can't think of one that really expects private systems to do what the social democracies tend to make into the welfare states, the
yeah.
things like healthcare, retirement, healthcare being the big one, education costs.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the United States, a lot of those buffers are, I mean, even health insurance, right? For years and years, we had it through private employment agreements and private employment contracts, and we have, you know, for-profit systems. And for me, having one of the reasons why our housing policies are so intractable is that we're not just talking about rich people when we're talking about homeowners who are banking on their home value going up. We are talking about people who will have very little at retirement if their home value does not appreciate.
Yeah.
And that is not housing's burden.
Well,
other than the fact that as a system, the United States has systematically backed away from any notion of a safety net.
Yeah.
Of a public safety net, so that, you know, the home that you own is the only real financial hedge you have against catastrophic illness. Right. And you know, how many votes to repeal ACA have we had since we've done it? And we're still arguing about Social Security, unambiguously,
right.
A social welfare policy that has succeeded in creating a lot of financial security on the part of seniors, even if there are all sorts of ways in which we might improve its capacity to generate funds
mm-hmm.
as a revenue source. We're still arguing about that. So the fact that Americans are afraid about things hurting their home values, it's easy in the discourse to kind of create these people as monsters mm-hmm. in our minds, right? Just selfish jerks who don't care
yeah.
about homeless people or people who go unsheltered because of their greed. But when you look at it from a social policy standpoint, and not just in the housing realm, of course they're hoarding, because there's no other capability in our system that allows them to really protect their families financially.
Yeah, it's by far, in many ways, the best investment you can make if you can afford it. And I think we're
most accessible, for sure.
Yeah.
And it's the most widely held asset, financial asset, among non-whites, much more so
yeah.
than stocks. And you know, I'm not saying that this is a good thing. There are going to be plenty of people who are going to be emailing us both and tweeting at us both going, that's not the way it should be. In Germany, they do this. And I'm like, yeah, I know.
How do we get there without, you know, a lot of wealth?
How do we crack that open in such a way that we really are able to let people, like, grasp things, right? Grasping so hard to that home value as an asset, and reassure them that there are ways that they can, you know, not have to eat cat food when they're 90.
Right. And I think your point about, you know, people of color, their households, I believe a larger share, obviously, you know, for Black households in particular, the wealth they have in any form is so much lower than the average white household. But among those who are homeowners, a much larger share of their total wealth is in housing compared to
that's right.
And so there's sort of less to lose in a sense, but that's no comfort.
That's no, yeah, that doesn't help.
Because you have no buffer in the right. first place.
Right.
And I think, you know, we're sort of running up against the limits of the system we have now, because, you know, for a while, for those who did have access to this system of equity and appreciation and everything, which was mostly white households, it worked for a while, because, you know, you could have prices going up 5% a year, or a few percent above inflation or whatever. and get richer and richer, or just more, you know, secure at least. But that can't go on forever, because eventually, at some point, a generation is just not going to be able to afford it. And that's sort of where we're at now, and only continues to get worse. And so it has to break at some point. And so we can let it just fall apart and try to pick up the pieces, which I know you don't want, I don't want, certainly. Or we can try to sort of dismantle it or redirect that energy somehow, which is a really big task. And, you know, I've been thinking if I wanted to write another book, and whether, you know, one angle, I'm still not sure if I believe this is the right path, but having a world where basically just everyone is a renter, in some ways really appeals to me. For one, like the idea of just being able to move to where you want to live and not being locked in because you bought a home and like that's your wealth and it's high transaction costs and all of these things to change it. But there's still trade-offs, because until we have that social welfare program in place that's really actually robust, if you just convert people to renters, I guess they don't have to worry about rent at least, but they still have to worry about all these things.
Yeah, see, this is the reason why you get so stuck on this, is that my concern here is enormous.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, Schweitzer, so I guess we reform the entire U.S. welfare state, and then, you know, we're able to then put housing in its proper role of just sheltering people. Mm-hmm. Instead of having it be this vehicle for so much of our social insurance,
yeah,
for lack of a better way to put that. The other kind of thing that I think is impoverishes the housing discourse, particularly in California, is our inability to really envision different ways of supplying schools.
What do you mean by that?
You know, we have a strong critique, and I think it's very believable that, you know, white people in particular hoard opportunities in their neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those is school quality.
Right.
And I run up against a hard bit of thinking in trying to understand how you change that.
Mm-hmm.
In a place where even very good public schools like California, even places with very good public schools, have people worried about classroom sizes.
Yeah.
And then you say to people, well, yes, this is one of the best school districts in the region. What we want to do is open it,
mm-hmm,
so that more kids have access to these opportunities. And absolutely, this, you know, my heart is like, yes. And then there's this other part of me that hears, well, how does, you know, when you open it up like that, and you increase class sizes, does that necessarily mean that the classes are less good?
Yeah.
And you start to affect the school quality? It's not even a question of who you're letting in, like those people, what have you. You could be letting in six little geniuses from wherever, right? And you're still got teachers with more kids to try to serve. And I just don't know enough about education to be able to say, oh no, that's not a problem, because we can do X and Y and still have excellent, you know, education service delivery when we make it possible. The other thing that I don't, you know, shouldn't we really be thinking about having all schools be great everywhere?
That would be great, yes.
Right, we don't want to, like, these are places, these neighborhoods are places where opportunities and amenities are hoarded.
Mm-hmm.
But wouldn't it be nice to have that lovely park in every place?
Yeah.
Right. It's one thing to kind of open up that neighborhood and make sure that more people can live in that neighborhood and have that lovely place, but wouldn't it be nice for other existing places to have more of that amenity too?
Yeah, that's, I feel like that's a tension that comes up in a lot of, not just housing, but urban planning generally. You know, it's the bringing the rail line or the bike lane to the low-income community of color. Is that improving the neighborhood, or is it gentrifying the neighborhood? And to an extent, I think the answer is both. And right. I think one answer you hear often is that if everywhere has these things, you're not really gentrifying, because you're not creating this one pocket where now things were not so great and now they're better, but everywhere is better. And so nowhere is really better relative to other places. And you can't flood every single neighborhood with rich white people all at the same time. So
right.
Sort of problem solved, but how you actually accomplish that, you know, the resources you need to commit.
Yeah, development occurs incrementally, project by project, whether we kind of like that or not. Yeah. I mean, if I could, I would dump, you know, 80,000 units on the city right now, but that isn't really how, even with improved approvals processes, that's not really how things happen.
Right. And that's part of why, you know, I do think the stability policies are really important, is even if you build enough housing, if you have all the systems in place to build enough housing to meet growing demand, for one, you just may not be able to keep up in real time. And so at the very least, there might be a couple of years lag between the demand sort of arriving and the supply catching up, and a lot can change in that time. And even if kind of regionally you're able to keep up with demand, maybe in local pockets you just can't, no matter what you do, because you just, and you wouldn't even want to, because the demand might grow so quickly that, you know, you don't want to double the density of a neighborhood necessarily in 10 years. That probably really is something to avoid.
Unless you have like four people living there.
Yeah. I mean, more like downtown actually is an example where you can do that, because there were, you know, not a lot of people living there in the first place, you know, excluding Skid Row, of course, and not much development other than supportive housing has occurred there. But
good existing transit accessibility.
Yeah, it was very accessible, lots of jobs. Right. That was somewhere where it was actually reasonable to do so. And I think they're sort of planning on doubling again before too long. And I think that's a good thing. But, you know, you can't, and I don't think you should want to do that in every place.
Have I converted you to my focus on downtown?
In what sense?
I remember you chiding me in sort of a puritanical way at one point, saying downtown can't solve our housing problems. And I was like, yeah, but it's a really good place to start.
I think you're mischaracterizing my, I think it should, I think the city says, I haven't followed it closely recently, but they're planning to grow from like 60,000 to 120,000 residents over the next 20 years. And at the time of those projections, that was 20% of the city's total population growth. And I said, you know, make it 200,000 residents. I'm fine with that. But it is still true that like not everyone wants to live there. You can only build so much in one place at one time because, you know, partially because not everyone wants to live in one neighborhood. And so how many people will actually move into those new units is limited. So I do think you have to go in a lot of different places, but downtown absolutely should be a big part of it. And it's, you know, the amount of service parking lots and one-story buildings a couple blocks from a subway station is just...
Yeah. I mean, for me, and, you know, like I said, I am teasing you a little bit because it's my right. And now that you have students of your own, you know that the joys of gloating with jazz hands to young people, it's too tempting for a weak woman like me. Largely because I think in downtown Los Angeles in particular, and we're getting a little specific for a book that really does have a lot of generalizable recommendations that go along, is that, you know, we had a lot of really pretty hard organized anti-development political action going on in Los Angeles. And my attitude on that was, why fight with those people when you have virtually no opposition downtown and a lot of space?
Right.
And already... except for, again, necessarily a lot of schools, right? A lot of school space, which I, you know, I'm not worried about my subway congesting. And I don't care if parking gets congested. Mm-hmm. But there are some urban services that just don't scale the way that those do.
Well, and LAUSD, and I think the state in general, but LAUSD in particular, they don't have a policy in how you build urban schools. They only have like the suburban campus style. And so that's something that, when I was at Central City Association, I didn't focus on education, but it was an interest among some of our staff and a lot of the members where they reached out to LAUSD, tried to find a way to bring a school. And for one, LAUSD said, you know, we only go off existing population, not projected population. And you have to have all of these, you know, open space requirements, and we don't allow things on second floors or, you know, I don't know the exact rules, but it was just, you couldn't do it without basically seizing an entire block of downtown, which is just possible, but, you know.
Something we should probably be thinking about.
Yeah, you'd be fighting a legal battle over it for 10 years before you got anything done, you know, aside from everything else, so.
I'm an old lady. 10 years doesn't feel that long to me.
It's fair, yeah.
For something like this, I mean, remember, I'm still waiting for that purple line.
Well, they've wanted something for already at least 10 years, I think, when the first buildings started coming in. And that's the problem, is there's really, as far as I can tell, not been a lot of progress. They've tried to do the charter school, and even the charter school, the limitations on where they can locate it in existing buildings has been really a challenge.
Yeah, that's kind of what I meant by, you know, thinking about new models of delivering education, new physical models of it. And it just, it's enormous. It's a big thing. And it's a lot, it falls in line with similar needs to reconceptualize policing.
Yeah.
In cities.
Well, and going back to your point about, you know, focusing on downtown because there's less opposition there, and you know, there is growing opposition even there.
You're going to lose that window.
Yeah, yeah. something I've really come to appreciate is you kind of want people doing all of the things at the same time. Much like my book is saying, you need to be doing supply and stability and subsidy. You know, I think you want the people doing the easy stuff, the low-hanging fruit, but you want people also kind of trying to shift Overton windows. So once that low hanging fruit is picked, you actually have somewhere else to go. You know, we saw that, in my opinion, that was kind of the success of the housing legislation in California the last several years, where you have SB 827 and SB 50, which are these big statewide, extraordinarily controversial upzoning bills that I supported and I wish had passed, especially the most recent version. But, you know, while those fights were occurring, we passed SB 35, we passed SB 828, we passed ADU, accessory dwelling unit legislation that effectively ended single family zoning throughout most of the state without really anyone paying attention. And all of those things are kind of forcing cities to do what those big controversial bills would have done anyway. But because they drew the attention, and these other ones are a little more technical and kind of procedural, we're going to end up at least a similar result, I think, which is, so I try to, you know, even if I disagree with some things that some people advocate for, I at least try to appreciate, like, well, maybe this is changing attitudes for the long run and pressuring people to at least come to a compromise position that would be, you know, better than nothing. So I think, again, we have to do it all, I guess.
You have to do it all. I mean, you know, nobody promised you that policy and planning was going to be easy. I'm in it for the fame and the money and the bitches.
And the point about doing it all, I don't know if I make that point in my book. I think I might like kind of close with this concept, but we all have different things that we care more about than others. You know, I came to housing policy focused very much on supply, and it was over time I came to appreciate the importance of these other things. And I know other people have kind of come from the other direction. And, you know, I still feel like I know more about supply, and I feel like it's more underappreciated than the other areas, even if all of them are extremely important. And so, you know, I probably do focus more of my attention there. And I think that's fine. And I think it's fine that other people focus their attention on rent strikes and things like that. And ultimately, I just feel like we have to come to a place where we can appreciate those other people and what they do and its importance, and find a way to work together, at the very least, not undermine one another as we often, you know, end up doing.
You cut out a little bit there, and I really want to understand your point. You said you still focus more on supply.
Yeah, I think.
I think it's misunderstood.
Yeah, I just have more research experience and background thinking about changes to zoning and density bonuses and value capture and those very specific types of things. And other people have a lot of experience working directly with tenants on, you know, the ways that landlords abuse their rights and fighting back against, you know, 100% rent hikes and things like that. And I think, you know, I will always have some things that I am more knowledgeable about and also maybe more passionate about. And I think that's fine. And I think it's fine for other people to have different things. We just have to find a way to work together and support each other when we agree, and try to find as many places where we do agree as possible, and and also just respect each other enough so that when I say, you know, I support rent control, but I'm a little concerned about vacancy control and what the impacts of that might be, because there's not a lot of good examples of it working in practice. I'm open to it, but I'm concerned. I hope I can be heard by people who are very focused on rent control. And when they express concern about, you know, a new development displacing existing residents and the compensation that we offer not being sufficient, you know, I hear that as well. I think that is really...
I thought that was very nice in the book, actually, Shane, how you had come around to this position of really being able to explain. I know that you came and talked about this in my class, actually, when we were talking about a ballot box measure here in LA in my class, that you really don't want to tempt right to return things. It's really much better to prioritize development that don't require even temporary displacement.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I thought that was a particularly nice section of the book when I was reading through. I'm going to say, I mean, for me, just in response for that reflecting, I know I catch a lot of flack from the supply guys.
Yeah.
Because I feel like my biggest priority is stability.
Yeah.
I think that these are by far the most vulnerable people in this whole equation.
Right.
And that there's always risk involved in policy and planning change. And by having government assume the financial risks of transitions instead of vulnerable people, mm-hmm. They have much less reason to oppose.
Yeah. Yeah.
What are really necessary development. You and I had this conversation once. Of course we need more units.
Right.
In a city with growing population, it's you know, of course we need more units. Of course we need to find ways to double up in ways that are sane and healthy for people and all sorts of things. But, you know, of course we need new supply. The question is how we do it.
Yeah.
And for me, one of the major problems with the early, very loud YIMBY was the knee-jerk reaction to rent control.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, you've got people who've been working on housing for 25 years talking about this as being very important to their constituencies, and you're just talking over the top of those folks, not you personally.
Mm-hmm. I probably did at one point, though. I wouldn't.
You really can't be doing that if you want people to join your coalition.
Yeah.
Even if you are concerned that rent control might, over time, cause some harm.
Yeah.
Through its market distortions, the question then to me is, well, how do you fix it?
Right.
And, you know, for me, the stability thing does get at the whole notion of, you know, so much of American social welfare and social insurance rides on the, you know, burdens the housing sector mm-hmm. with things that housing isn't actually meant to address,
yeah.
right? Our pension policy, our retirement policy, our health policy, our education policy, those things are landing on housing.
Yeah.
And it's just more than the sector should be expected to bear. But if we shore up the focus on stability and helping people maintain their housing, mm-hmm. then we can start to try to decouple that in a way that people don't have to start getting frantic.
Right.
With the complete knowledge that absolutely there's no reason for any American to trust that there's going to be a robust social policy there to help them. I mean, we're in the middle of a pandemic where every model of good governance really does say, you know, if you're going to get into debt to support your people, this would be the time to do it. And we're still not really delivering
yeah.
aid to people.
Yeah.
Even in a crushing economy where no narratives of deservingness or virtue about a person's financial condition might hold, mm-hmm. still not capable of delivering social support and financial support to people.
And as you say, this is putting a lot on housing, but I, you know, in the current environment, I'm not sure we have an alternative, nothing in the near term. And if we can say to renters of all kinds, but especially low-income and renters and communities of color, that development is not going to threaten your home.
That's right.
It just isn't. It can't. Because
we're not going to let it.
Because of all of these policies enacted so that it literally cannot happen. You can't have your rent raised if you're beyond a certain level, even if your neighborhood becomes Inglewood, you know. You can't be evicted just because someone wants to convert it to a condo. I think there's a line there where you can say, like, redevelopment can happen even in some of these places, but maybe it has to be entirely voluntary where everyone in the building agrees and they say, you know what, I prefer the deal you're offering me to staying in my home with a stabilized rent. Like, I think the alternative that is in front of me, that is my choice to accept or reject, is better. And I think that's perfectly fine. But in general, I think we have the resources, not just public, but, you know, the amount of investment that goes into housing and relative to, you know, what it takes to help just a few people, which is usually all that is at risk when you're doing a redevelopment. I think we can say either nothing will happen to you, like you are secure, or your apartment being demolished and redeveloped is going to be like winning the lottery. Having your property redeveloped, your apartment redeveloped, you're going to be compensated in such a way that, you know, your rent is going to be covered for the entire interim of the redevelopment. You're going to get to move into a unit of at least the same size and features, and of course, probably nicer because it's newer, in the same place at the same rent, stabilized forever as long as you want. I know that we can offer those things. And honestly, we don't even have to go there yet. We can really just say, if a tenant lives there, it's just off limits for now. We're only going to focus on places where it's owner-occupied, like single-family neighborhoods, or a commercial strip or a parking lot where no one lives. And we can do a lot there, but we have to actually have the zoning to permit that, because, and that's why, you know, this, why I wrote the book. I think both things work better when they're done together. If you just have the rent control, but you don't allow for more housing, people right now who are secure in their home now might be better off, but in the long run, you're going to run into problems. And the same with just doing supply. You may stabilize prices at the regional level and even at the neighborhood level in some cases, but some people are going to be kind of run over through that process. And I just don't think we have to make that trade-off, but it's, you know, the debate is framed in that way. And I think we need to move past it.
You know, it's in this kind of framing that you and I are both very comfortable working in, which is the market framing. You know, it's very easy to lay aside the valid and well-evidenced concerns of people who worry about the way in which the local neighborhood culture changes. Mm-hmm. And I see a lot of reductive arguments made about that too. You know, if you bring up neighborhood character immediately on Twitter, everybody starts talking about dog whistles for racism. And certainly, but that's really depending on who's saying the words.
Yeah, of course.
You know, and we really do have places in California and in U.S. cities that have been historically Black neighborhoods for a long time. And a whole influx of outsiders is going to irrevocably change that place. Mm-hmm. And there's just no instance where adding a whole bunch of white people to a place necessarily increases the quality of life and self-determination of the Black residents of that place.
Well, this is also one of the things I've raised, in that the gentrification is not just economic.
Right.
And, you know, this is where Barbecue Becky and these things come from, where,
right,
you know, maybe your rent isn't going up, maybe you're perfectly secure, but maybe your life is now literally at risk in a way that it wasn't before, because having a barbecue on your street gets the cops called on you. And for a Black person, that might end your life.
Right.
And, you know, if they're...
Or just, you know, all the neighborhood businesses change.
Yeah.
You know, all the places that you grew up around. And I'm sympathetic to the people who want to problematize the language around speaking about culture and place. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, as planners and as people who care about cities, I do want people to love their neighborhoods the way they are.
Yeah.
And when you do have people who love a place... And this is not to discount the ways in which white supremacist systems in cities and the way white neighborhoods exploit those rules to create exclusionary spaces.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That's, you know, but just because, you know, empowered and entitled people abuse a concept doesn't mean that it's a bad concept.
Right.
They have the power to use this in a punishing and self-benefiting way. And that, you know, when I do think something real is lost when grandma's house is bulldozed along with her garden and a high rise is put up. Mm-hmm. This doesn't mean that I don't want the people in the high rise to have a house.
Right.
right? It doesn't mean I want them to have shelter. It means that what is there matters to people now. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that's something that's worth taking seriously outside. And in addition to really being very critical.
Yeah.
And with people who make these claims about what they want their neighborhoods to look like.
Yeah. And I think that matters. We shouldn't completely discount that, no matter who's saying it. Even if it is in a primarily white community, it still matters to some extent. It doesn't mean it overrides other.
It doesn't mean it decides the question.
Yeah. But I think, you know, to the broader point, I think you're absolutely right. And there just needs to be more of an appreciation for the fact that who is saying these things really matters. And so, you know, someone living in a $4 million home in Bel Air, you know, when they talk about neighborhood character, that's a very different thing than someone who's renting out of a fourplex in Limmer Park.
That's right. That's right.
And, you know, that's true whether they're...
And I think it's entirely valid for us to turn around to say to the one, look, here's the world's tiniest violin, you know, and to say to the other, you know what, we'll go at your pace.
Yeah. And I'm not sure I'm going to be the best at like putting this into words, but something I read recently, I suspect you read it too. It was Whiteness in Urban Planning, or it was by Goetz.
Yep.
And something that he pointed out was, you know, we problematize concentrated poverty among communities of color, but we don't really treat concentrations of white affluence as problematic, even though, you know, something I strongly agree with, those concentrations of white affluence, they exist because of, they benefit from, they exploit those concentrated racial poverty, in part because they are more valuable, because certain people who don't want to live around people of color will pay more. And whether you as an individual living in a concentrated white area feel that way personally is sort of irrelevant, because you're still benefiting from it. And so you have some obligation to...
Those are policy systems, that's right. Regardless of the intent, right, these outcomes matter anyway. Even if not a single person in that development has a hood in their basement or a World War II souvenir collection, right? Even if none of those people have it, the fact that these outcomes have the outcomes that they do is a sign of a system that's designed to serve them.
Yeah, and there's a something I've appreciated more and more is really in no aspect of policy, community, anything, does intent really matter that much?
Exactly. Oh, you see a lot of good faith, bad faith arguments, and I think those might be useful in political discourse, but they're not really in policy.
Yeah.
Right? Your intentions are one thing, your outcomes really do. At some point, you have to sort of break those two up and kind of go, you know, I don't care if you're a bad person, if you've got a good policy idea that actually serves what we're trying to do here, then I'm going to take it.
Yeah.
Right? And, you know, I think, I think politically, just in the discourse, there's an expedience to using bad faith, good faith arguments, but otherwise I find them kind of specious and boring. Right? Like if a person I don't like tells me it's 3 o'clock and I'm going to be like, is it really 3 o'clock? Does he really want to convey that information to me, or is he really trying to subvert me in some way? What are you working on now?
We got a few grants going on. So you talked about expediting projects. We're studying some things happening in LA and how that's actually affecting affordability and timelines on projects. I'm not sure I can or should say much more. I'm new to academia, so I don't know what you're allowed to reveal. but that's a big one. Otherwise, yeah, I'm always working on the little policy entrepreneurship stuff. So just recently, we published a pretty big paper report on real estate transfer taxes and kind of the opportunity to use this to raise money for affordable housing and other things. And, you know, I always talk smack about linkage fees, which are charged to developers. You know, that was something that they said it would raise $100 million a year. Which isn't that much to begin with, to be honest, but in practice, it's raising something like 20. And this proposal, which is applied to all property owners who sell their property eventually, in the city of LA alone, would raise between around $600 million and $1 billion a year from people who are in exactly the position to pay, because it's right when you sell your home. And actually, in a kind of follow-up blog post, I talked about applying like a multiplier to that payment based on how much you've benefited from Proposition 13 and the tax, property tax discounts you've received from that. So trying to do things like that to really, you know, I had a paper on reforming rent stabilization to make it stronger, which actually Councilmember Bonin picked up into a motion, which was cool. And also, you know, we have these, let's just build more housing and here's how to do it kind of things. And also let's raise more money in better and more equitable ways to fund these things that are all great. So trying to do a little bit of everything.
You should tell us where your blog is.
Oh, my blog, which I only write at very rarely, but I think I might come back to a little more, is called Better Institutions.
There's a lot of good stuff in the archives there.
Yeah. I've even got a best of page. it's called Better Institutions, betterinstitutions.com. And actually, so the introduction to the book is a story of a redevelopment that took place or is in the process of taking place in Hollywood. And that actually came from a blog post of about 4 years ago. So in some ways, seeing that project and the details of it was the inspiration or genesis of the book.
You know, over at UCLA, there's a law faculty who wrote one of my very favorite pieces. Cheryl Harris wrote a wonderful piece called Whiteness as Property, which fits very nicely with it. And she wrote it years ago, but it's an absolutely marvelous piece. Which fits really nicely with the Ed Getz piece that we were talking about. It just occurs to me that we should mention that for people who are interested. And that she, too, is a UCLA-ite. Is there anything that you're burning to talk about that we haven't covered? Lost track of the time. We've gone quite long, but that's fine for me. I just want to make sure that you, if there's anything you'd like to leave us with.
No, I don't think so. I guess I should say that the book title again, maybe, and
oh, I'll do that.
Okay, it's actually technically one thing I should note. Maybe is that the release date isn't officially until September 15th. There's your copy.
Yep.
But if you go to the Island Press website, it actually is for sale now and is shipping. I've seen a lot of people who have already received it. So if you want it sooner, that's the place to get it. But otherwise, it's out on September 15th.
You want to make sure that you get your copy before Island Press runs out.
Yes, I'm sure they will.
All right. The book is called The Affordable City, Strategies for Putting Housing Within Reach and Keeping It There. The author is Shane Phillips, my guest today. Thank you so much for being with us today, Shane.
Thank you, Lisa.
The book is from Island Press, and I, again, reinforce my endorsement of making sure that you both buy Shane's wonderful book and a couple copies for your friends for all your wonky housing needs so that you too can talk smack about linkage fees like the gangster Shane Phillips. It's also available on ebook, right?
It is, yes.
Also available for download on ebook. So it's one of those that you should pick up. Thank you so much again, Shane. I don't see you enough. I see you on Twitter, but that is a poor substitute to actually being able to talk to you in person.
Indeed. Good to see you.
All right. Well, that's all we're going to have time for today. Thanks again, Shane. A big thank you to our listeners. To find our whole suite of podcasts exploring governance and civics, search USC Bedrosian on your favorite podcasting app. And of course, we'd love for you to leave a review on Apple Podcasts so that more people can find us. You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today on our website, bedrosian.usc.edu/bookclub. If you're reading along with us, and I really hope that you are, our read for the month of September is The Ghost Map, the story of London's most terrifying epidemic and how it changed science, cities, and the modern world by Stephen Johnson. Thanks again to our guests, to our co-producers Aubrey Hicks and Jonathan Swartz, and a huge thanks to our beloved sound editors, the Brothers Heddens, who I have not seen in months. And if I ever see you guys again, Corey and Ryan, I have a big sack of candy for you. I'm signing off. I'm Lisa Schweitzer, coming to you earbuds from the University of Southern California, Saul Price School of Public Policy. Thanks for listening. We'll catch up, and please keep reading.